Chapter 50. The cry, "Christians to the lions," was heard increasingly in every part of the city. At first, not only did no one doubt that they were the real authors of the catastrophe, but no one wished to doubt, since their punishment was to be a splendid amusement for the populace. Still, the opinion spread that the catastrophe would not have assumed such dreadful proportions, but for the anger of the gods. For this reason, iaculia, or purifying sacrifices, were commanded in the temples. By advice of the Sibylline books, the Senate ordained solemnities and public prayer to Vulcan, Ceres, and Proserpina. Matrons made offerings to Juno. A whole procession of them went to the seashore to take water and sprinkle with it the statue of the goddess. Married women prepared feasts to the gods and night watches. All Rome purified itself from sin, made offerings, and placated the immortals. Meanwhile, new broad streets were opened among the ruins. In one place and another, foundations were laid for magnificent houses, palaces, and temples. But first of all, they built with unheard of haste an enormous wooden amphitheater in which Christians were to die. Immediately after that consultation in the house of Tiberius, orders went to consuls to furnish wild beasts. Tigellinus emptied the Vivaria of all Italian cities, not excepting the smaller ones. In Africa, at his command, gigantic hunts were organized, in which the entire local population was forced to take part. Elephants and tigers were brought in from Asia, crocodiles and hippopotamuses from the Nile, lions from the Atlas, wolves and bears from the Pyrenees, savage hounds from Hibernia, Molossian dogs from Epirus, bisons and the gigantic wild oryxes from Germany. Because of the number of prisoners, the games were to surpass in greatness anything seen up to that time. Caesar wished to drown all memory of the fire in blood, and make Rome drunk with it. Hence never had there been a greater promise of bloodshed. The willing people helped guards and praetorians in hunting Christians. That was no difficult labor for whole groups of them camped with the other population in the midst of the gardens, and confessed their faith openly. When surrounded, they knelt, and while singing hymns let themselves be borne away without resistance. But their patience only increased the anger of the populace, who, not understanding its origin, considered it as rage and persistence in crime. A madness seized the persecutors. It happened that the mob wrested Christians from praetorians and tore them to pieces. Women were dragged to prison by the hair. Children's heads were dashed against stones. Thousands of people rushed, howling, night and day through the streets. Victims were sought in ruins, in chimneys, in cellars. Before the prison, bacchanalian feasts and dances were celebrated at fires, around casks of wine. In the evening, was heard with delight bellowing which was like thunder, and which sounded throughout the city. The prisons were overflowing with thousands of people. Every day the mob and praetorians drove in new victims. Pity had died out. It seemed that people had forgotten to speak, and in their wild frenzy remembered one shout alone, "Colon to the lions with Christians." Wonderfully hot days came, and nights more stifling than ever before. The very air seemed filled with blood, crime, and madness. And that surpassing measure of cruelty was answered by an equal measure of desire for martyrdom. The confessors of Christ went to death willingly, or even sought death till they were restrained by the stern commands of superiors. By the injunction of these superiors, they began to assemble only outside the city, in excavations near the Appian Way, and in vineyards belonging to patrician Christians, of whom none had been imprisoned so far. It was known perfectly on the Palatine that to the confessors of Christ belonged Flavius, Domitilla, Pomponia Gracina, Cornelius Pudens, and Vinicius. Caesar himself, however, feared that the mob would not believe that such people had burned Rome, and since it was important beyond everything to convince the mob, punishment and vengeance were deferred till later days. Others were of the opinion, but erroneously, that those patricians were saved by the influence of act. Petronius, after parting with Vinicius, turned to act, it is true, to gain assistance for Lydia, but she could offer him only tears, for she lived in oblivion and suffering, and was endured only in so far as she hid herself from Poppaea and Caesar. But as he had visited Lydia in prison, as he had carried her clothing and food, and above all, had saved her from injury on the part of the prison guards, who, moreover, were bribed already. Petronius, unable to forget that had it not been for him, and his plan of taking Lydia from the house of Aulus, probably she would not be in prison at that moment, and, besides, wishing to win the game against Tigellinus, spared neither time nor efforts. In the course of a few days he saw Seneca, Domitius Afer, Crispinilla, and Diodorus, through whom he wished to reach Poppaea. He saw Terpnos, and the beautiful Pythagoras, and finally Lycurus and Paris, to whom Caesar usually refused nothing. With the help of Chrysothemis, then mistress of Vatinius, he tried to gain even his aid, not sparing in this case and in others promises and money. But all these efforts were fruitless. Seneca, uncertain of the morrow, fell to explaining to him that the Christians, even if they had not burned Rome, should be exterminated, for the good of the city. In a word, he justified the coming slaughter for political reasons. Terpnos and Diodorus took the money, and did nothing in return for it. Vatinius reported to Caesar that they had been trying to bribe him. A Lycurus alone, who at first was hostile to the Christians, took pity on them then, and made bold to mention to Caesar the imprisoned maiden, and to implore in her behalf. He obtained nothing, however, but the answer, "Dost thou think that I have a soul inferior to that of Brutus, who spared not his own sons for the good of Rome?" When this answer was repeated to Petronius, he said, "Since Nero has compared himself to Brutus, there is no salvation." But he was sorry for Vinicius, and dread seized him lest he might attempt his own life. "And now," thought the arbiter, "he is upheld by the efforts which he makes to save her, by the sight of her, and by his own suffering. But when all means fail, and the last ray of hope is quenched, by Castor, he will not survive, he will throw himself on his sword." Petronius understood better how to die thus than to love, and suffer like Vinicius. Meanwhile Vinicius did all that he could think of to save Lydia. He visited Augustians, and he, once so proud, now begged their assistance. Through Vitellius he offered to Tigellinus all his Sicilian estates, and whatever else the man might ask, but Tigellinus, not wishing apparently to offend the Augusta, refused. To go to Caesar himself, embrace his knees and implore, would lead to nothing. Vinicius wished, it is true, to do this, but Petronius, hearing of his purpose, inquired, "But should he refuse thee, or answer with a jest or a shameless threat, what wouldst thou do?" At this the young tribune's features contracted with pain and rage, and from his fixed jaws a gritting sound was heard. "Yes," said Petronius, "I advise thee against this, because thou wouldst close all paths of rescue." Vinicius restrained himself, and passing his palm over his forehead, which was covered with cold sweat, replied, "No, no, I am a Christian. But thou wilt forget this, as thou didst a moment ago. Thou hast the right to ruin thyself, but not her. Remember what the daughter of Sejanus passed through before death." Speaking thus he was not altogether sincere, since he was concerned more for Vinicius than for Lydia. Still he knew that in no way could he restrain him from a dangerous step as well as by telling him that he would bring inexorable destruction on Lydia. Moreover he was right, for on the Palatine they had counted on the visit of the young tribune, and had taken needful precautions. But the suffering of Vinicius surpassed human endurance. From the moment that Lydia was imprisoned, and the glory of coming martyrdom had fallen on her, not only did he love her 100 times more, but he began simply to give her in his soul almost religious honor, as he would a superhuman being. And now, at the thought that he must lose this being both loved and holy, that besides death torments might be inflicted on her more terrible than death itself, the blood stiffened in his veins. His soul was turned into one groan, his thoughts were confused. At times it seemed to him that his skull was filled with living fire, which would either burn or burst it. He ceased to understand what was happening. He ceased to understand why Christ, the merciful, the divine, did not come with aid to his adherents, why the dingy walls of the Palatine did not sink through the earth, and with them Nero, the Augustians, the Praetorian camp, and all that city of crime. He thought that it could not, and should not be otherwise. And all that his eye saw, and because of which his heart was breaking, was a dream. But time roaring of wild beasts informed him that it was reality. The sound of the axes beneath which rose the arena told him that it was reality. The howling of the people and the overfilled prisons confirmed this. Then his faith in Christ was alarmed, and that alarm was a new torture, the most dreadful of all, perhaps. Remember what the daughter of Sejanus endured before death, said Petronius to him meanwhile. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.